wasn't meant to die here any more than Moses was meant to go over into Canaan with the children of Israel. She paused. The two men watched her soberly in the lamplight, and outside the rain continued to fall, slow and ceaseless. There was no more thunder. Lord, she thought, these dentures hurt my mouth. I want to take them out and go to bed. I started having dreams 2 years before this plague ever fell. I've always dreamed, and sometimes my dreams have come true. Prophecy is the gift of God, and everyone has a smidge of it. My own grandmother used to call it the shining lamp of God, sometimes just the shine. In my dreams, I saw myself going west. At first with just a few people, then a few more, then a few more. West, always west until I could see the Rocky Mountains. It got so there was a whole caravan of us, 200 or more. And there would be signs. No, not signs from God, but regular road signs, and every one of them saying things like, Boulder, Colorado, 609 miles, or this way to Boulder. She paused. Those dreams, they scared me. I never told a soul I was having them. That's how scared I was. I felt the way I guess Job must have felt when God spoke to him out of the whirlwind. I even tried to pretend they was just dreams, foolish old woman running from God the way Jonah did. But the big fishes swallowed us up just the same, you see. And if God says to Abby, you got to tell, then tell I must. And I always felt like someone would come to me, someone special, and that's how I'd be in the way of knowing the time had come. She looked at Nick, who sat at the table and regarded her solemnly with his good eye through the haze of Ralph Brentner's cigarette smoke. I knew when I saw you, she said. It's you, Nick. God has put his finger on your heart. But he has more fingers than one, and there's others out there still coming on, praise God, and he's got a finger on them, too. I dream of him, how he's looking for us even now. And God forgive my sick spirit, I curse him in my heart. She began to weep and got up to have a drink of water and a splash. Her tears were the human part of her, weak and flagging. When she turned back, Nick was writing. At last he ripped the page off his pad and handed it to Ralph. I don't know about the God part, but I know something is working here. Everyone we've met has been moving north. As if you had the answer. Have you dreamed about any of the others? Dick, June, or Olivia, maybe the little girl? Not any of these others. A man who doesn't talk much. A woman who is with child. A man of about your age who comes to me with a guitar of his own. And you, Nick. And do you think going to Boulder is the right thing? Mother Abigail said, it's what we're meant to do. Nick doodled aimlessly on his pad for a moment and then wrote, How much do you know about the Dark Man? Do you know who he is? I know what he's about, but not who he is. He's the purest evil left in the world. The rest of the bad is little evil, shoplifters and sex fiends and people who like to use their fists. But he'll call them. He's started already. He's getting them together a lot faster than we are. Before he's ready to make his move, I guess he'll have a lot more. Not just the evil ones that are like him, but the weak ones, the lonely ones, the ones that have left God out of their hearts. Maybe he's not real, Nick wrote. Maybe he's just... He had to nibble at the top of his pen and think. At last he added, The scared, bad part of all of us. Maybe we are dreaming of the things we're afraid we might do. Ralph frowned over this as he read it aloud, but Abby grasped what Nick meant right off. It wasn't much different from the talk of the new preachers who had got on the land in the last 20 years or so. There wasn't really any Satan, that was their gospel. There was evil, and it probably came from original sin, but it was in all of us, and getting it out was as impossible as getting an egg out of its shell without cracking it. According to the way these new preachers had it, Satan was like a jigsaw puzzle, and every man, woman, and child on earth added his or her little piece to make up the whole. Yes, all that had a good modern sound to it. The trouble with it was that it wasn't true. and if Nick was allowed to go on thinking that, the dark man would eat him for dinner. She said, "You dreamed of me. Ain't I real?" Nick nodded. "And I dreamed you. Ain't you real? Praise God, you're sitting right over there with a pad of paper on your knee. This other man, Nick, he's as real as you are." Yes, he was real. She thought of the weasels, and of the red eye opening in the darkness, and when she spoke up again, her voice was husky. "He ain't Satan," she said, "but he and Satan know of each other, and have kept their counsels together of old. The Bible, it don't say what happened to Noah and his family after the flood went down, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was some awful tussle for the souls of those few people, for their souls, their bodies, their way of thinking. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was what was on for us. He's west of the Rockies now. Sooner or later he'll come east. Maybe not this year, no, but when he's ready. And it's our lot to deal with him." Nick was shaking his head, disturbed. "Yes," she said quietly. "You'll see. There's bitter days ahead. Death and terror, betrayal and tears. And not all of us will be alive to see how it ends." "I don't like any of this," Ralph muttered. "Aren't things hard enough without this guy you and Nick are talking about? Ain't we got enough problems with no doctors or electricity or nothing? Why did we have to get stuck with this damn door prize?" "I don't know. It's God's way. He don't explain to the likes of Abby Freemantle." "If this is his way," Ralph said, "why, I wish he'd retire and let somebody younger take over." "If the dark man is west," Nick wrote, "maybe we ought to pick up stakes and move east." She shook her head patiently. "Nick, all things serve the Lord. Don't you think this black man serves him too?" "He does, no matter how mysterious his purpose may be. The black man will follow you no matter where you run, because he serves the purpose of God. And God wants you to treat with him. It don't do no good to run from the will of the Lord God of hosts. A man or woman who tries that only ends up in the belly of the beast." Nick wrote briefly. Ralph studied the note, rubbed the side of his nose, and wished he didn't have to read it. Old ladies like this didn't cotton to stuff like what Nick had just written. She'd likely call it a blasphemy and shout it loud enough to wake everybody in the place, too. "What's he say?" Abigail asked. "He says," Ralph cleared his throat, the feathers stuck in the band of his hat jiggled, "he says that he don't believe in God." The message relayed, he looked unhappily down at his shoes and waited for the explosion. But she only chuckled, got up and walked across to Nick. She took one of his hands and patted it. "Bless you, Nick, but that don't matter. He believes in you." They stayed at Abby Freemantle's place the next day, and it was the best day any of them could remember since the superflu had drawn away, like the waters going down from Mount Ararat. The rain had stopped sometime during the early hours of the morning, and by 9 o'clock the sky was a pleasant Midwest mural of sun and broken clouds. The corn twinkled away in all directions like a ransom of emeralds. It was cooler than it had been for weeks. Tom Cullen spent the morning running up and down the rows of corn, his arms outstretched, scaring up droves of crows. Gina McCone sat contentedly in the dirt by the tire swing, playing with a large number of paper dolls Abigail had found at the bottom of a trunk in her bedroom closet. A little earlier, she and Tom had had a pleasant game of cars and trucks around the Fisher-Price garage Tom had taken from the Five and Dime in May, Oklahoma. Tom did what Gina wanted him to do willingly enough. Dick Ellis, the vet, came diffidently to Mother Abigail and asked her if anyone in the area had kept pigs. "Why, the Stoners always had pigs," she said. She was sitting on the porch in her rocker, cording her guitar and watching Gina at play in the yard, her broken leg in its cast stuck out stiffly in front of her. "Think any of them might still be alive?" "You'd have to go see, might be. Might be they've busted down their pens and gone hog wild." Her eyes gleamed. Might also be I know a fellow who dreamed about pork chops last night.
Could be you do, Dick said.
You ever slaughtered a hog?
No, ma'am, he said, grinning broadly now. Wormed a few, but haven't slaughtered any hog. I was always what you'd call nonviolent.
Do you think you and Ralph there could stand a woman foreman?
Could be, he said.
20 minutes later, the three of them were off, Abigail riding between the two men in the Chevy's cab with her cane planted regally between her knees. At the Stoners, they found 2-yearling pigs in the back pen, healthy and full of beans. It appeared that when the feed had given out, they had taken to dining on their weaker and less fortunate penmates. Ralph set up Reg Stoner's chainfall in the barn, and at Abigail's direction, Dick was finally able to get a rope firmly around the back leg of one of the yearlings. Squealing and thrashing, it was yanked into the barn and hung upside down from the chainfall. Ralph came out of the house with a butcher knife 3 feet long.
That ain't a knife, that's a regular bayonet, praise God, Abby thought.
You know I don't know if I can do this, he said.
Well, give her here, then, Abigail said, and then held out her hand.
Ralph looked doubtfully at Dick. Dick shrugged. Ralph handed the knife over.
Lord, Abigail said, we thank thee for the gift we are about to receive from thy bounty. Bless this pig that it might nourish us. Amen. Stand clear, boys, she's going to go a gusher.
She cut the pig's throat with one practiced sweep of the knife, some things you never forgot no matter how old you got, and then stepped back as quickly as she could.
You got that fire going under the kettle? She asked Dick. Nice hot fire out there in the dooryard?
Yes, ma'am, Dick said respectfully, unable to take his eyes from the pig.
You got those brushes? She asked Ralph.
Ralph displayed 2 big scrub brushes with stiff yellow bristles.
Well, then you want to haul him over and dump him in. After he's boiled a while, those bristles will scrub right off. After that, you can peel old Mr. Hog just like a banana.
They both looked a trifle green at the prospect.
Lively, she said, you can't eat him with his jacket on. Got to get him undressed first.
Ralph and Dick Ellis looked at each other, gulped, and began to lower the pig from the chainfall. They were done by 3 that afternoon, back at Abigail's by 4 with a truckload of meat, and there were fresh pork chops for dinner. Neither of the men ate very well, but Abigail put away 2 chops all by herself, relishing the way the crisp fat crackled between her dentures. There was nothing like fresh meat you'd seen to yourself. It was some time after 9 o'clock. Gina was asleep, and Tom Cullen had dozed off in Mother Abigail's rocker on the porch. Soundless lightning flickered against the sky far to the west. The other adults were gathered in the kitchen, except for Nick, who had gone for a walk. Abigail knew what the boy was wrestling with, and her heart went out to him.
"Say, you're not really 108, are you?"
Ralph asked, remembering something she had said that morning as they set out on the hog-slaughtering expedition.
"You wait right there," Abigail said. "I've got something to show you, Mr. Man."
She went into the bedroom and got her framed letter from President Reagan out of the top drawer of her bureau. She brought it back to Ralph and put it in his lap.
"Read that, sonny," she said pridefully.
Ralph read it.
"Occasion of your 100th birthday, one of 72 proven centenarians in the United States of America. 5th oldest registered Republican in the United States of America. Greetings and congratulations from President Ronald Reagan, January 14, 1982.
He looked up at her with wide eyes.
Well, I'll be dipped in shit.
He stopped, blushing and in confusion.
Pardon me, ma'am.
All the things you must have seen, Olivia marveled.
None of it so very much compared to what I've seen in the last month or so.
She sighed.
Or what I expect to see.
The door opened, and Nick came in. Conversation broke off as if they had all been marking time, waiting for him. She could see in his face that he had made his decision, and she thought she knew what it was. He handed her a note that he had written out on the porch, standing by Tom. She held the note at arm's length to read it.
"We'd better start for Boulder tomorrow," Nick had written. She looked from the note to Nick's face and nodded slowly. She passed the note on to June Brinkmeyer, who passed it to Olivia.
"I guess we had," Abigail said. "I don't want to any more than you, but I guess we had better."
"What made up your mind?" He shrugged almost angrily and pointed at her.
"So be it," Abigail said. "My faith's in the Lord."
Nick thought, "I wish mine was." The next morning, July 26th, after a brief conference, Dick and Ralph set off for Columbus in Ralph's truck.
"I hate to trade her in," Ralph said, "but if it's the way you say it is, Nick, okay."
Nick wrote, "Be back as soon as you can." Ralph uttered a short laugh and looked around the yard. June and Olivia were washing clothes in a large tub with a scrub board stuck on one end. Tom was in the corn, scaring crows, an occupation he seemed to find endlessly diverting. Gina was playing with his corgi cars and his garage. The old woman sat dozing in her rocker, dozing and snoring.
"You're in one tearing hurry to stick your head in the lion's mouth, Nicky."
Nick wrote, "Have we got any place better to go?"
"That's true. It's no good just wandering around. It makes you feel kind of worthless. A person don't hardly feel right unless he's looking forward. You ever notice that?"
Nick nodded.
"Okay." Ralph clapped Nick on the shoulder and turned away. "Dick, you ready to take a ride?"
Tom Cullen came running out of the corn, silk clinging to his shirt and pants and long blonde hair.
"Me too. Tom Cullen wants to go on the ride, too. Laws, yes."
"Come on, then," Ralph said. "Here, look at you, corn silk from top to bottom and fore to aft. You ain't caught a crow yet. Better let me brush you off."
Grinning vacantly, Tom allowed Ralph to brush off his shirt and pants. For Tom, Nick reflected, these last 2 weeks had probably been the happiest of his life. He was with people who accepted and wanted him. Why shouldn't they? He might be feeble, but he was still a comparative rarity in this new world, a living human being.
"See you, Nicky," Ralph said, and climbed up behind the wheel of the Chevy.
"See you, Nicky,"
Tom Cullen echoed, still grinning. Nick watched the truck out of sight, then went into the shed and found an old crate and a can of paint. He broke out one of the crate's panels and nailed a long piece of picket fence to it. He took the sign and the paint out into the yard and carefully daubed on it while Gina looked over his shoulder with interest.
"What does it say?" she asked.
"It says, 'We have gone to Boulder, Colorado. We are taking secondary roads to avoid traffic jams. Citizens Band Channel 14,' Olivia read.
"What does that mean?" June asked, coming over.
She picked Gina up, and they both watched as Nick carefully planted the sign so that it faced the area where the dirt road became Mother Abigail's driveway. He buried the bottom 3 feet of the picket. Nothing but a big wind would knock it over now. Of course, there were big winds out in this part of the world. He thought of the one which had almost carried him and Tom away, and of the scare they'd had in the cellar. He wrote a note and handed it to June. "One of the things Dick and Ralph are supposed to get in Columbus is a CB radio. Someone will have to monitor Channel 14 all the time."
"Oh," Olivia said. "Smart."
Nick tapped his forehead gravely, then smiled. The two women went back to hang their clothes. Gina returned to the toy cars, hopping nimbly on one leg. Nick walked across the yard, mounted the porch steps, and sat down next to the dozing old woman. He looked out over the corn and wondered what was going to become of them.
"If that's the way you say it is, Nick, okay."
They had turned him into a leader. They had done that, and he couldn't even begin to understand why. You couldn't take orders from a deaf mute. It was like a bad joke. Dick should have been their leader. His own place was a spear carrier, third from the left. No lines, recognized only by his mother. But from the time they had met Ralph Brentner pottering up the road in his truck, not really going anywhere, that business of saying something and then glancing quickly at Nick as if for confirmation had begun. A fog of nostalgia had already begun to creep over those few days between Shoyo and May, before Tom and responsibility.
It was easy to forget how lonely he had been, the fear that the constant bad dreams might mean he was going crazy. Easy to remember how there had been only yourself to look out for. A spear carrier, third from the left, a bit player in this terrible play. "I knew it when I saw you. It's you, Nick. God has put his finger on your heart." "No, I don't accept that. I don't accept God either, for that matter. Let the old woman have her God. God was as necessary for old women as enemas and Lipton tea bags. He would concentrate on one thing at a time, planting one foot ahead of the other. Get them to Boulder, then see what came next. The old woman said the dark man was a real man, not just a psychological symbol. And he didn't want to believe that either. But in his heart he did. In his heart, he believed everything she had said, and it scared him. He didn't want to be their leader. "It's you, Nick." A hand squeezed his shoulder, and he jumped with surprise, then turned around. If she had been dozing, she wasn't anymore. She was smiling down at him from her armless rocker. "I was just sitting here and thinking on the Great Depression," she said. "Do you know my daddy once owned all this land for miles around? It's true. No small trick for a black man. And I played my guitar and sang down at the Grange Hall in 1902. Long ago, Nick, long, long ago." Nick nodded. "Those were good days, Nick. Most of them were, anyway. But nothing lasts, I guess. Only the love of the Lord. My daddy died and the land was split between his sons with a piece for my first husband, 60 acres, not much. This house stands on part of that 60, you know. 4 acres, that's all that's left. Oh, I guess now I could lay claim to all of it again, but 'twouldn't be the same somehow." Nick patted her scrawny hand and she sighed deeply. "Brothers don't always work so well together. They almost always fall to squabbling. Look at Cain and Abel. Everyone wanted to be a foreman and nobody wanted to be a field hand. Comes 1931 and the bank called its paper home. Then they all pulled together, but by then it was most too late. By 1945 everything was gone but my 60, and 40 or 50 more where the Goodell place is now." She fumbled her handkerchief from her dress pocket and wiped her eyes with it, slowly and thoughtfully. "Finally, there was only me left, with no money nor nothing. And each year, when tax time came round, they'd take a little more to pay it off. And I'd come out here to look at the part that wasn't my own anymore, and I'd cry over it like I'm crying now. A little more each year for taxes, that's how it happened. A whack here, a whack there. I rented out what was left, but it was never enough to cover what they had to have for their cussed taxes. Then when I got to be 100 years old, they remanded the taxes in perpetuity. Yes, they give it over after they'd taken everything but this little piece of scratch that's here. Big of them want it." He squeezed her hand lightly and looked at her. "Oh, Nick," Mother Abigail said, "I have harbored hate of the Lord in my heart. Every man or woman who loves him, they hate him too, because he's a hard God, a jealous God. He is what he is. And in this world he's apt to repay service with pain, while those who do evil ride over the roads in Cadillac cars. Even the joy of serving him is a bitter joy. I do his will, but the human part of me has cursed him in my heart. Abby, the Lord says to me, there's work for you far up ahead, so I'll let you live and live until your flesh is bitter on your bones. I'll let you see all your children die ahead of you, and still you'll walk the earth. I'll let you see your daddy's land taken away piece by piece. And in the end, your reward will be to go away with strangers from all the things you love best, and you'll die in a strange land with the work not yet finished. That's my will, Abby," says he. "And yes, Lord," says I, "thy will be done." And in my heart I curse him and ask, why? And the only answer I get is, where were you when I made the world?" Now her tears came in a bitter flood, running down her cheeks and wetting the bodice of her dress. and Nick marveled that there could be so many tears in such an old woman, who seemed as dry and thin as a dead twig.
"Help me along, Nick," she said. "I only want to do what's right."
He held her hands tightly. Behind them, Gina giggled and held one of the toy cars up to the sky for the sun to shine and sparkle on. Dick and Ralph came back at noon, Dick behind the wheel of a new Dodge van, and Ralph driving a red wrecker truck with a pushboard on the front and the crane and hook dangling from the back. Tom stood in the rear, waving grandly. They pulled up by the porch, and Dick got out of the van.
"There's a hell of a nice CB in that wrecker," he told Nick. 40-channel job. I think Ralph's in love with it."
Nick grinned. The women had come over and were looking at the trucks. Abigail's eyes noted the way Ralph squired June over to the wrecker so she could look at the radio equipment, and approved. The woman had a good set of hips on her. There would be a fine porch door down there between them. She could have just about as many little ones as she wanted.
"So when do we go?" Ralph asked.
Nick scribbled, "Soon as we eat. Did you try the CB?"
"Yep," Ralph said. "I had it on all the way back. Horrible static. There's a squelch button, but it doesn't seem to work very well. But you know, I swear I did hear something, static or no static. Far off. Might not have been voices at all. But I'll say the truth, Nicky. I didn't care for it much. Like those dreams."
A silence fell among them.
"Well," Olivia said, breaking it, "I'll get something cooking. Hope nobody minds pork 2 days in a row."
No one did, and by 1 o'clock the camping things, and Abigail's rocker and guitar, had been stowed in the van and they were off, the wrecker now lumbering ahead to move anything blocking the road. Abigail sat up front in the van as they drove westbound on Route 30. She did not cry. Her cane was planted between her legs. Crying was done. She was set in the center of the Lord's will, and His will would be done. The Lord's will would be done, but she thought of that red eye opening in the dark heart of the night, and she was afraid.
Chapter 46. It was late evening, July 27th. They were camped on what the sign, now half-demolished by summer storms, proclaimed to be the Kunkel Fairgrounds. Kunkel itself, Kunkel, Ohio, was south of them. There had been some sort of fire there, and most of Kunkel was gone. Stu said it had probably been lightning. Harold had, of course, disputed that. These days, if Stu Redmond said a fire truck was red, Harold Lauder would produce facts and figures proving that most of them these days were green. She sighed and rolled over. Couldn't sleep. She was afraid of the dream. To her left, the 5 motorcycles stood in a row, heeled over on their kickstands, moonlight twinkling along their chromed exhaust pipes and fittings. As if a band of Hell's Angels had picked this particular spot to crash for the night. Not that the Angels ever would have ridden such a pussycat bunch of bikes as these Hondas and Yamahas, she supposed. They had driven hogs. Or was that just something she had picked up from the old American International bike epics she'd seen on TV? The Wild Angels, the Devil's Angels, Hell's Angels on Wheels. The bike pictures had been very big at the drive-ins when she had been in high school. Wells Drive-In, Sanford Drive-In, South Portland Twin, you pays your money and you takes your choice. Now kaput. All the drive-ins were kaput. Not to mention the Hell's Angels and good old American International Pictures. "Put it in your diary, Franny," she told herself, and rolled over on her other side. Not tonight. Tonight she was going to sleep, dreams or no dreams. 20 paces from where she was lying, she could see the others, zonked out in their sleeping bags like Hell's Angels after a big beer party, the one where everybody in the picture got laid except for Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra. Harold, Stu, Glenn Bateman, Mark Braddock, Perry and McCarthy. "Take Sominex tonight and sleep." It wasn't Sominex they were on, but half a grain of Veranol apiece. It had been Stu's idea when the dreams got really bad and they all began to get flaky and hard to live with. He had taken Harold aside before mentioning it to the rest of them, because the way to flatter Harold was to soberly ask his opinion, and also because Harold knew things. It was good that he did, but it was also rather spooky, as if they had a fifth-rate god traveling with them, more or less omniscient, but emotionally unstable and likely to fragment at any time. Harold had picked up a second gun in Albany, where they had met Mark and Parian, and now he wore the two pistols crisscrossed low on his hips like a latter-day Johnny Ringo. She felt badly for Harold, but Harold had also begun to frighten her. She had begun to wonder if Harold might not just go crackers some night and start blazing away with his two pistols. She often found herself remembering the day she had come upon Harold in his backyard, all his emotional defenses demolished, mowing the lawn in his bathing suit and crying. She knew just how Stu would have put it to him, very quietly, almost conspiratorially. "Harold, these dreams are a problem. I've got an idea, but I don't know exactly how to carry it out. A mild sedative, but it would have to be just the right dose. Too much and nobody would wake up if there was trouble. What do you suggest?" Harold had suggested they try a whole grain of Veranol, available at any drugstore, and if that interrupted the dream cycle, that they cut back to 3/4 of a grain, and if that worked, to half. Stu had gone privately to Glenn, had gotten a concurring opinion, and the experiment had been tried. At 1/4 grain, the dreams had begun to creep back in, so they held the dosage at 1/2. At least for the others. Franny accepted her drug each night, but palmed it. She didn't know if Veranol would hurt the baby or not, but she was taking no chances. They said that even aspirin could break the chromosome chain. So she suffered the dreams. Suffered. That was the right word. One of them predominated. If the others were different, they would sooner or later blend into this one. She was in her Ogunquit house, and the dark man was chasing her. Up and down shadowy corridors, through her mother's parlor where the clock continued to tick off seasons in a dry age. She could get away from him, she knew, if she didn't have to carry the body. It was her father's body, wrapped in a bedsheet, and if she dropped it, the dark man would do something to it, perform some awful desecration on it. So she ran, knowing that he was getting closer and closer, and at last his hand would fall on her shoulder, his hot and sickening hand. She would go boneless and weak. Her father's shrouded corpse would slither out of her arms. She would turn, ready to say, "Take him, do anything, I don't care, just don't chase me anymore." And there he would be, dressed in some dark stuff like a hooded monk's robe, nothing visible of his features save his huge and happy grin. And in one hand he held the bent and twisted coat hanger. That was when the horror struck her like a padded fist, and she struggled up from sleep, her skin clammy with sweat, her heart thudding, wanting never to sleep again. Because it wasn't the dead body of her father he wanted. It was the living child in her womb. She rolled over again. If she didn't go to sleep soon, she really would take her diary out and write in it. She had been keeping the journal since July 5th. In a way, she was keeping it for the baby. It was an act of faith, faith that the baby would live. She wanted it to know what it had been like, how the plague had come to a place called Ogunquit, how she and Harold had escaped, what became of them. She wanted the child to know how things had been. The moonlight was strong enough to write by, and 2 or 3 pages of diary were always enough to make her feel snoozy. Didn't say much for her literary talents, she supposed. She would give sleep one more fair chance first, though. She closed her eyes and went on thinking of Harold. The situation might have eased with the coming of Mark and Parian if the two of them hadn't already been committed to each other. Parian was 33, 11 years older than Mark, but in this world such things made little difference. They had found each other, they had been looking out for each other, and they were content to stick together. Parian had confided to Franny that they were trying to make a baby. "Thank God I was on the pill and didn't have a loop," Perry said. "How in God's name would I ever have gotten it out?" Franny had almost told her about the baby she was carrying. She was over 1/3 of the way along now. But something held her back. She was afraid it might make a bad situation even worse. So now there were 6 of them instead of 4, Glenn refused utterly to try driving a motorcycle and always rode pillion behind Stu or Harold. But the situation hadn't changed with the addition of another woman. What about you, Franny? What do you want? If she had to exist in a world like this, she thought, with a biological clock inside her set to go off in 6 months, she wanted someone like Stu Redmond to be her man. No, not someone like. She wanted him. There it was, stated with complete baldness. With civilization gone, all the chrome and gewgaws had been stripped from the engine of human society. Glenn Bateman held forth on this theme often, and it always seemed to please Harold inordinately. Women's lib, Franny had decided, thinking that if she were going to be bald, she might as well go totally bald, was nothing more nor less than an outgrowth of the technological society. Women were at the mercy of their bodies. They were smaller. They tended to be weaker. A man couldn't get with child, but a woman could. Every four-year-old knows it. And a pregnant woman is a vulnerable human being. Civilization had provided an umbrella of sanity that both sexes could stand beneath. Liberation. That one word said it all. Before civilization, with its careful and merciful system of protections, women had been slaves. Let us not gild the lily. Slaves was what we were, Fran thought. Then the evil days ended, and the women's credo, which should have been hung in the offices of Ms. Magazine, preferably in needlepoint, was just this. Thank you, men, for the railroads. Thank you, men, for inventing the automobile and killing the Red Indians who thought it might be nice to hold on to America for a while longer, since they were here first. Thank you, men, for the hospitals, the police, the schools. Now I'd like to vote, please, and have the right to set my own course and make my own destiny. Once I was chattel, but now that is obsolete. My days of slavery must be over. I need to be a slave no more than I need to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a tiny boat with sails. Jet planes are safer and quicker than little boats with sails, and freedom makes more sense than slavery. I am not afraid of flying. Thank you, men. And what was there to say? Nothing. The rednecks would grunt about burning bras, the reactionaries could play intellectual little games, but the truth only smiles. Now all that had changed. In a matter of weeks it had changed. How much only time would tell. But lying here in the night, she knew that she needed a man. Oh, God, she badly needed a man. Nor was it all a matter of preserving herself and her baby, of looking out for number one, and she supposed number two. Stu attracted her, especially after Jess Ryder. Stu was calm, capable, and most of all, he was not what her father would have called 20 pounds of bullshit in a 10-pound bag. He was attracted to her as well. She knew that perfectly well, had known it since that first lunch together on the 4th of July in that deserted restaurant. For a moment, just one moment, their eyes had met, and there had been that instant of heat, like a power surge when all the needles swing over to overload. She guessed Stu knew how things were too, but he was waiting on her, letting her make her decision in her own time. She had been with Harold first, therefore she was Harold's chattel. A stinking macho idea, but she was afraid this was going to be a stinking macho world again, at least for a while. If only there was someone else, someone for Harold, but there wasn't, and she was afraid she could not wait long. She thought of the day Harold, in his clumsy way, had tried to make love to her, to make his claim of ownership irrevocable. How long ago? 2 weeks? It seemed longer. All the past seemed longer now. It had pulled out like warm Bonomo's Turkish taffy. Between her worry of what to do about Harold, and her fears of what he might do if she did go to Stuart, and her fears of the dreams, she would never get to sleep. So thinking, she drifted off. When she woke up, it was still dark. Someone was shaking her. She muttered some protest. Her sleep had been restful and without dreams for the first time in a week, and then came reluctantly out of it, thinking that it must be morning and time to get going. But why would they want to get going in the dark? As she sat up, she saw that even the moon was down. It was Harold shaking her, and Harold looked scared. "Harold, is something wrong?" Stu was also up, she saw, and Glenn Bateman. Parian was kneeling on the far side of the place where their small fire had been.
"It's Mark," Harold said. "He's sick."
"Sick?" she said. And then a low moan came from the other side of the campfire's ashes, where Parian was kneeling and the two men were standing. Franny felt dread rise up inside her like a black column. Sickness was the thing they were all most afraid of.
"It isn't the flu, is it, Harold?"
Because if Mark came down with a belated case of Captain Trips, that meant any of them could. Perhaps the germ was still hanging around. Perhaps it had even mutated. The better to feed on you, my dear.
"No, it's not the flu. It's nothing like the flu. Fran, did you eat any of the canned oysters tonight? Or maybe when we stopped for lunch?"
She tried to think, her mind still fuzzy with sleep.
"Yes, I had some both times," she said. "They tasted fine. I love oysters. Is it food poisoning? Is that what it is?"
"Fran, I'm just asking. None of us know what it is. There isn't a doctor in the house. How do you feel? Do you feel all right?"
"Fine, just sleepy."
But she wasn't. Not anymore. Another groan floated over from the other side of the camp, as if Mark were accusing her of feeling well while he did not. Harold said,
"Glenn thinks it might be his appendix."
"What?" Harold only grinned sickly and nodded. Fran got up and walked across to where the others were gathered. Harold trailed her like an unhappy shadow.
"We've got to help him," Parian said.
She spoke mechanically, as if she had said it many times before. Her eyes went from one of them to the next relentlessly, eyes so full of terror and helplessness that Franny once again felt accused. Her thoughts went selfishly to the baby she was carrying, and she tried to push the thoughts away. Inappropriate or not, they wouldn't go. "Get away from him," part of her screamed at the rest of her. "You get away from him right now, he might be catching." She looked at Glenn, who was pale and old-looking in the steady glow of the Coleman lantern.
"Harold says you think it's his appendix?" she asked.
"I don't know," Glenn said, sounding upset and scared. "He's got the symptoms, certainly. He's feverish. His belly is hard and swelled, painful to touch."
"We've got to help him," Parian said again, and burst into tears.
Glenn touched Mark's belly, and Mark's eyes, which had been half-lidded and glazed, opened wide. He screamed. Glenn jerked his hand away as if he had put it on a hot stove, and looked from Stu to Harold and then back to Stu again, with barely concealed panic. "What would you two gentlemen suggest?" Harold stood with his throat working convulsively as if something was stuck in there and choking him. At last he blurted, "Give him some aspirin." Parian, who had been gazing down at Mark through her tears, now whirled to look at Harold.
"Aspirin?"
she asked. Her tone was one of furious astonishment.
"Aspirin?"
This time she shrieked it.
"Is that the best you can do with all your big talk smartassery? Aspirin?"
Harold stuffed his hands into his pockets and looked at her miserably, accepting the rebuke. Stu said very quietly, "But Harold's right, Parian. For now, aspirin's just about the best we can do. What time is it?"
"You don't know what to do," she screamed at them. "Why don't you just admit it?"
"It's 3:15, Franny said.
"What if he dies?"
Parry pushed a sheaf of dark auburn hair away from her face, which was puffed from crying.
"Leave them alone, Parry,"
Mark said in a dull, tired voice. It startled them all.
"They'll do what they can. If it goes on hurting as bad as this, I think I'd rather be dead anyway. Give me some aspirin, anything."
"I'll get it," Harold said, eager to be away. "There's some in my knapsack. Extra strength Excedrin," he added, as if hoping for their approval, and then he went for it, nearly scuttling in his hurry.
"We've got to help him," Parian said, returning to her old scripture.
Stu drew Glenn and Franny off to one side. "Any ideas what to do about this?" he asked them quietly.
"I don't have any, I can tell you."
She was mad at Harold, but his aspirin idea was just about twice as good as any I've had.
"She's upset, that's all," Fran said.
Glenn sighed.
"Maybe it's just his bowels,"
Too much roughage. Maybe he'll have a good movement and it'll clear up.
Franny was shaking her head. I don't think that's it. He wouldn't be running a fever if it was his bowels. And I don't think his belly would have swelled up that way either.
It had almost looked as if a tumor had swelled up there overnight. It made her feel ill to think about it. She could not remember when, except for when she was dreaming the dreams, she had been so badly frightened. What was it Harold had said? There's no doctor in the house. How true it was, how horribly true. God, it was all coming at her at once, crashing down all around her. How horribly alone they were, how horribly far out on the wire they were, and somebody had forgotten the safety net. She looked from Glenn's strained face to Stu's. She saw deep concern in both of them, but no answers in either of them. Behind them, Mark screamed again, and Parian echoed his cry as if she felt his pain. In a way, Franny supposed that she did. "What are we going to do?" Franny asked helplessly. She was thinking of the baby, and over again the question which dinned its way into her mind was, "What if it has to be a cesarean? What if it has to be a cesarean? What if—" Behind her, Mark screamed again like some horrible prophet, and she hated him. They looked at each other in the trembling dark. From Fran Goldsmith's Diary, July 6, 1990. After some persuasion, Mr. Bateman has agreed to come along with us. He says that after all his articles, I write them in big words so no one will really know how simple-minded they are, he says, and boring 20 years of students to death in SY1 and SY2, not to mention the sociology of deviant behavior and rural sociology, he has decided he can't afford to turn down this opportunity. Stu wanted to know what opportunity he meant. I think we should be clear, says Harold, in that insufferably snotty way of his. Sometimes Harold can be a dear, but he can also be a real booger snot, and tonight he was being the latter. Mr. Bateman, please call me Glenn, says he very quietly, but the way Harold glared at him, you would have thought he had accused Harold of having some social disease. Glenn, as a sociologist, sees the opportunity to study the formation of a society firsthand, I believe. He wants to see how fact compares with theory. Well, to make a long story short, Glenn, which I will call him from now on since that's what he likes, agreed that was mostly it, but added, I also have certain theories which I've written down and hope to prove or disprove. I don't believe that man arising from the ashes of the superflu is going to be anything like man arising from the cradle of the Nile with a bone in his nose and a woman by the hair. That's one of the theories. Stu said, in that quiet way he has, because everything is lying around waiting to be picked up again. He looked so grim when he said it that I was surprised, and even Harold looked at him sort of funny. But Glenn just nodded and said, that's right. The technological society has walked off the court, so to speak, but they've left all the basketballs behind. Someone will come along who remembers the game and teach it to the rest again. That's rather neat, isn't it? I ought to write it down later. But I've written it down myself, just in case he forgets. Who knows? The shadow do, hee-hee. So then Harold says, you sound as if you believe the whole thing will start up again, the arms race, the pollution, and so on. Is that another of your theories, or a corollary to the first one? Not exactly, Glenn started to say, but before he could go any further, Harold burst in with his own chicken bone to pick. I can't put it down word for word, because when he gets excited, Harold talks fast, but what he said amounted to how, even though he had a pretty low opinion of people in general, he didn't think they could be that stupid. He said he thought that this time around, certain laws would be made. No one would be fiddling around with badass stuff like nuclear fission and fluorocarbon, probably spelled that one wrong, oh well, sprays and stuff like that. I do remember one thing he said because it was a very vivid image. Just because the Gordian knot has been cut for us is no reason for us to go to work and tie it back up. I could see he was just spoiling for an argument. One of the things that makes Harold hard to like is how eager he is to show off how much he knows. And he sure does know a lot. I can't take that away from him. Harold is super bright. But all Glenn said was, time will tell, won't it? That all finished up about an hour ago, and Now I am in an upstairs bedroom with Kojak lying on the floor beside me. Good dog. It is all rather cozy, reminds me of home. But I'm trying not to think about home too much because it makes me weepy. I know this must sound awful, but I really wish I had someone to help me warm this bed. I even have a candidate in mind.
Put it out of your mind, Franny.
So, tomorrow we're off for Stovington, and I know Stu doesn't like the idea very much. He's scared of that place. I like Stu very much, only wish Harold liked him more. Harold is making everything very hard, but I suppose he can't help his nature. Glenn has decided to leave Kojak behind. He is sorry to have to do that, even though Kojak will have no trouble finding forage. Still, there is nothing else for it unless we could find a motorcycle with a sidecar, and even then poor Kojak might get scared and jump out, hurt or kill himself. Anyway, tomorrow we'll be going. Things to remember. The Texas Rangers baseball team had a pitcher named Nolan Ryan who pitched all kinds of no-hitters and things with his famous fastball, and a no-hitter is very good. There were TV comedies with laugh tracks, and a laugh track was people on tape laughing at the funny parts, and they were supposed to make you have a better time watching. You used to be able to get frozen cakes and pies at the supermarket and just thaw them out and eat them. Sara Lee's strawberry cheesecake was my personal favorite. July 7th, 1990. Can't write long. Cycled all day. My fanny feels like hamburger, and my back feels like there's a rock in it. I had that bad dream again last night. Harold has also been dreaming about that man, and it upsets the hell out of him because he can't explain how both of us can be having what is essentially the same dream. Stu says he is still having that dream about Nebraska and the old black woman there. She keeps saying he should come and see her any time. Stu thinks she lives in a town called Holland Home or Hometown or something like that. Says he thinks he could find it. Harold sneered at him and went into a long spiel about how dreams were psycho-Freudian manifestations of things we didn't dare think about when we were awake. Stu was angry, I think, but kept his temper. I'm so afraid that the bad feeling between them may break out into the open. I wish it didn't have to be this way. Anyway, Stu said, "So how come you and Franny are having the same dream?" Harold muttered something about coincidence and just stalked off. Stu told Glenn and I that he would like us to go to Nebraska after Stovington. Glenn shrugged and said, "Why not? We have to go somewhere." Harold, of course, will object on general principles. Damn you, Harold, grow up. Things to remember. There were gasoline shortages in the early 80s because everybody in America was driving something and we had used up most of our oil supplies and the Arabs had us by the short hairs. The Arabs had so much money they literally couldn't spend it. There was a rock and roll group called The Who that sometimes used to finish their live performances by smashing their guitars and amplifiers. This was known as conspicuous consumption. July 8, 1990. It's late and I'm tired again, but I should try to get as much down as I possibly can before my eyelids just slammed shut. Harold finished his sign about an hour ago, with much bad grace, I must say, and put it on the front lawn of the Stovington installation. Stu helped him put it up and held his peace in spite of all Harold's mean little jibes. I had tried to prepare myself for the disappointment. I never believed Stu was lying, and I really don't think Harold believed he was either. So I was sure everybody was dead, but still, it was an upsetting experience, and I cried. I couldn't help myself. But I wasn't the only one who was upset. When Stu saw the place, he turned almost dead white. He had on a short-sleeved shirt, and I could see he had goosebumps all up and down his arms. His eyes are normally blue, but they had gone a slaty color, like the ocean on a gray day. He pointed up to the third floor and said, "That was my room." Harold turned toward him, and I could see him getting ready with one of his patented Harold Lauder smart-ass comments. But then he saw Stu's face and shut up. I think that was very wise of him, actually. So after a little while, Harold says, "Well, let's go in and look around." "What would you want to do that for?" Stu answers, and he sounded almost hysterical, but keeping it under a tight rein.
It scared me, more so because he is usually as cool as ice water. Witness what little success Harold has had getting under his skin.
"Stuart," Glenn starts, but Stu interrupts with, "What for? Can't you see it's a dead place? No brass bands, no soldiers, no nothing. Believe it," he says. "If they were here, they'd be all over us by now. We'd be up in those white rooms like a bunch of fucking guinea pigs." Then he looks at me and says, "Sorry, Fran, I didn't mean to talk that way. I guess I'm upset."
"Well, I'm going in," Harold says. "Who's coming with me?"
But I could see that even though Harold was trying to be big and bold, he was really scared himself.
Glenn said he would, and Stu said, "You go in too, Fran. Have a look. Satisfy yourself." I wanted to say I'd stay outside with him because he looked so uptight, and because I really didn't want to go in either, you know. But that would have made more trouble with Harold, so I said okay.
If we, Glenn and I, had really had any doubts about Stu's story, we could have dropped them as soon as we opened the door. It was the smell. You can smell the same thing in any of the fair-sized towns we've traveled through. It's a smell like decayed tomatoes and, oh God, I'm crying again. But is it right for people not just to die, but then to stink like... Wait. Later. There. I've had my second good cry of the day. Whatever can be happening to Lil' Fran Goldsmith, our gal Sal, who used to be able to chew up nails and spit out carpet tacks, ha-ha, as the old saying goes. Well, no more tears tonight, and that's a promise. We went inside anyway, morbid curiosity, I guess. I don't know about the others, but I kind of wanted to see the room where Stu was held prisoner. Anyway, it wasn't just the smell, you know, but how cool the place was after the outside. A lot of granite and marble and probably really fantastic insulation. It was warmer on the top two floors, but down below was that smell. And the cool... It was like a tomb. Yuck. It was also spooky, like a haunted house. The three of us were all huddled together like sheep, and I was glad I had my rifle, even if it is only a .22. Our footsteps kept echoing back to us as if there was someone creeping along, following us, you know. And I started thinking about that dream again, the one starring the man in the black robe. No wonder Stu didn't want to come with us. We wandered around to the elevators at last and went up to the second floor. Nothing there but offices and several bodies. The third floor was made up like a hospital, but all the rooms had airlock doors. Both Harold and Glenn said that's what they were. And special viewing windows. There were lots of bodies up there, in the rooms and in the hallways, too. Very few women. Did they try to evacuate them at the end, I wonder? There's so much we'll never know. But then, why would we want to? Anyway, at the end of the hall leading down from the main corridor where the elevator core was, we found a room with its airlock door open. There was a dead man in there, but he wasn't a patient. They were all wearing white hospital johnnies. And he sure didn't die of the flu. He was lying in a big pool of dried blood, and he looked like he'd been trying to crawl out of the room when he died. There was a broken chair, and things were all messed up as if there'd been a fight. Glenn looked around for a long time and then said, "I don't think we'd better say anything about this room to Stu. I believe he came very close to dying in here." I looked at that sprawled body and felt creepier than ever. "What do you mean?" Harold asked, and even he sounded hushed. It was one of the few times I ever heard Harold talk as if what he was saying wasn't going out on a public address system. "I believe that gentleman came in here to kill Stuart," Glenn said, "and that Stu somehow got the better of him." "But why?" I asked. "Why would they want to kill Stu if he was immune? It doesn't make any sense."
He looked at me, and his eyes were scary. His eyes looked almost dead, like a mackerel's eyes.
"That doesn't matter, Fran," he said. "Sense didn't have much to do with this place from the way it looks. There is a certain mentality that believes in covering up. They believe in it with the sincerity and fanaticism that members of some religious groups believe in the divinity of Jesus. Because for some people, the necessity to continue covering up even after the damage is done is all important. It makes me wonder how many immunes they killed in Atlanta and San Francisco,
and the Topeka Viral Center before the plague finally killed them and made an end to their butchery. This asshole? I'm glad he's dead. I'm only sorry for Stu, who will probably spend the rest of his life having nightmares.